As Tim says, my name's Jonathan. I've been, and I wanted to say right at the beginning, I'm not a teacher, I'm a student, I'm a co-student of everyone, because I regard the idea of being a teacher of Mahayana belongs really to a ordained or somebody who's been empowered with that, and I don't regard myself as having been that. I did take a refuge ceremony, and I do take the Buddhist path very seriously, but I'm very much a layperson, very much a student, and somebody who just finds the subject fascinating and edifying, and endlessly inspiring. So that's been my motivation for studying. The course that Tina mentioned that I did was the Master of Buddhist Studies degree at the University of Sydney during 2011 and 12, which I really did for no reason other than the love of the subject, because I don't have an academic sort of career or anything, but it's just something that I've really wanted to understand in greater depth and detail. In fact, the 2 years I spent at the University of Sydney, I was lucky enough to be working in a sort of a remote, or like what you call a telecommuting job. So I could take my notebook computer to the University of Sydney, sit in the student lab, work away for most of the day, and then duck off to classes and do lectures and things, and then go back. It was just the best 2 years. If I could have extended that course for the next 20 years, I would never have done anything else. I had excellent teachers there, including Mark Allon, who's a sort of, what's the name of the fellow Harrison Ford plays? Indigo. He's like Indiana Jones, yeah. He's this dashing young sort of archaeologist of Pali, of the ancient Buddhist texts, so forth. And they have to buy these things on the black market. They only ever come up when people are trying to sell them for huge money. So they buy these birch bark manuscripts from Afghanistan, and then he's one of the 3 or 4 people in the world that can actually read them. So that was my academic background. As far as the Mahayana goes, my exposure to it is mostly self-educated. I've met some illustrious practitioners over the years, one of whom was a very influential and well-known monk by the name of Lama Geshe, who died, unfortunately, very young from a congenital heart condition only in the 1980s. But he came and gave a talk at the Paddington Town Hall, opposite where I'm working at the moment, in the late 1970s and early 80s, which had huge influence on development of Buddhism in Australia, and the Chen Rezeg Retreat Centre up on the Sunshine Coast was started by one of his students, and he was also involved with the foundation of a group called the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, FPMT, and they're still active in all over the world, and they've got a really good online course, so that's an advertisement for them. I'll mention them again later. Because if you do want to study Mahayana Buddhism, and it's something which takes a lot of study, because there's a lot in it, the FPMT courses are very a really excellent resource, and they're properly managed. Like, you've got to enrol and log in and go through them in order and such. So the rise of the Mahayana. Oh, I love this slide. I didn't make it, I found it. Let's keep going. That's it. It's an animated one. Now, I don't know all of these words. I only know some of these schools. Some of them I recognise. Some of them you really have to be a scholar to recognise. The Theravada are there. Then many of these schools were, not many of them, some of them were started by illustrious Dharma teachers over the centuries, and then others grew around central kinds of ideas, like the Sarvastivada are still a very important influence in Buddhism today. And then, that's where all the asterisks are, all the ones that contributed to the rise of the Mahayana. But scholars think that the Mahayana started with this group called the Mahasamgika, which means the Great Assembly. And it is a fact, though, that the origin of Mahayana as a separate tradition is lost in the mists of time. Because all you've got to go on are ancient manuscripts and inscriptions, some stone, like statues, reliquaries, archaeological deposits of various kinds, but it's very, very scattered. Like, it's an amazing fact that when the British controlled India, they didn't realise for 150 or 200 years that there had been Buddhism in India, because it had been so thoroughly wiped out from the Indian landscape that they didn't recognise any of the Buddhist archaeological relics, just regarded as being associated with various Hindu schools. It had almost disappeared. And so it wasn't until they'd been there for 100 years or so that they started to realise that Buddhism had an Indian origin and that it had been a Buddhist country at one stage. So this is one of the reasons I say that the origins of the Mahayana are so mysterious, because there's not a lot of archaeology, there's not a lot to go on. Generally speaking, you'll see over there in that corner the Theravada.
Yeah.
Nowadays, when we talk about the major schools, generally speaking, you'll hear about it divided into three, which is the Theravada, which we still see in, as you know from the talks you're coming to here, in Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and so on. And that word actually means the doctrine of the elders. Then the Mahayana, which is the outgrowth of that ancient Mahasamgika school. The majority of the Mahayana schools are Chinese, Japanese, and Korean nowadays. And the Mahayana has also been preserved in Tibet, but Tibet also has what's called the Vajrayana tradition, which is the tantric tradition, which is something I'm not going to touch on because it's such a huge subject in its own right. So those Mahayana teachings and the tantric teachings coexist in Tibet, in most of the rest of Asia, in most of the rest of China, Japan and Korea. Most of them are essentially Mahayana in their... and we'll go into the differences and the divisions between them in a bit more detail.
So, Jonathan, yeah. the council at, was it Vaisali?
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, I can't give you the dates of all the councils, but the point of the Buddhist councils was all of the Sangha came together and they all recited all of the teachings. This is where they... Now, for the first few hundred years, probably 500 years of the existence of the Buddhist Sangha, there was nothing written at all. The Buddha didn't write. And in his day, writing was, how should we say, a very small minority of people were literate. So everything was committed to memory. And so, according to legend, the first Buddhist council was where they all came together and they nominated several of the senior disciples to recite the entire corpus of what the Buddha had taught, which is why all of the verses in the Pali canon, which are called in the Agama in Chinese, but they're the Nikayas in Pali, begin with, "Thus have I heard," which is Ananda, usually, who was the Buddha's attendant, reciting what he'd heard the Buddha say. And Ananda had, according to legend, a photographic memory. He just recalled it in massive detail. So the councils were really getting all of this, as I say, they were eventually written down, but they were firstly just memorised. And they also resulted in the division of all of the teachings into what's called the Tipitaka, the three baskets, which is the Sutra, which is the sayings of the Buddha, the Vinaya, which is the monastic regulations that govern the conduct of the monks, and also the Abhidhamma, which is the higher teachings to do with philosophy, psychology, and the principles behind the Buddhist teaching. So the reason they're called three baskets is because when they were eventually committed to script, they were engraved on palm leaves and they were carried in baskets, and there were three of them. Mm-hmm. Hello, welcome. So now I can't recall all of the details of all of the councils, but I think one of the subsequent councils, this is where, how shall we say, some divergences of opinion arose between what was called this great assembly, the Mahasamgika. I'll just hide this. Let's go back. Yes, that's a big slide, that one. I want to introduce that carefully. There was, I think, fairly early in the piece, this sort of divergence of views arose as regarding the meaning of the Buddhist teaching. And this is the part that's controversial. When I went to university, first of all, I did comparative religion as a subject in the late 1980s and early 90s. And the story we were told then was that there was a sort of a split between the... not so much a split, but a lot of the laity were dissatisfied with the fact that they could only participate in the Buddhist faith by supporting the monks. And they felt as though there wasn't an opportunity to really undergo spiritual training in the lay community. That was the first thing. There was said to be a bit of dissension about whether the arahat, who was the perfectly realised being, was still subject to further painting defilements. So there was a dispute about the status of the Arahat as a spiritual sort of station of development. There was a dispute about carrying money, because a lot of the Buddhist missionaries who had to fan out along the Silk Roads and interact with other kinds of cultures found it very difficult to beg for alms in situations where there hadn't been Buddhists previously, and the whole custom of the Buddhists going for alms hadn't been established. So there was a dispute about that, but I think underneath that as well, there was a real there was the emergence of this much more, how shall we say, liberal type of attitude towards the whole meaning of the Buddha's teaching. And it was, if you read, there's a very famous Buddhist scholar by the name of Eduard Konza, who's a German, or he worked most of his life in England, but he was of German descent, but he lived in England and taught at Oxford University and those other English universities for most of the 50s and 60s. And he's a very noted scholar of the early Mahayana texts. And his view was that, he said there was this division between what was called the old wisdom school, which was the Theravada, because Theravada means the doctrine of the elders. And the Theravada sees itself as being the day preserving the original word of the Buddha. This is, and they still, they, the Theravada will say that the Pali scriptures that they've got are the nearest facsimile to what the original teaching was. Whereas the Mahayana, the emerging Mahasamgika movement, had more of an emphasis on what they called the inner meaning of the teaching. And so they were much more prepared to interpret it allegorically. And this is what Konza called the new wisdom school. And they were sort of a vastly different kind of mentality. They were actually pretty radical in a lot of ways. And so that's what I want to sort of emphasize. The Mahayana was like, at the time, it was really a religious and a cultural revolution in India. Nobody had really seen anything like it. So this next quote, I'll put it up, it's quite a long quote, so take time to read it. This is from a Russian scholar called Stabatsky, who was went out and into the field in the like 1910s and 20s, still quite early in the piece. You've got to realise that in those days there was, we didn't have global communications, and still not very much known about the actual Buddhist cultures. So he came up with this description of what he saw as the emergence of the Mahayana. So I'll leave, I might read it. We see a non-theistic, soul-denying, philosophic teaching of a path to personal final liberance, comprising the absolute end, like the extinction of personal existence, and a simple worship of the memory of the Buddha, human founder. This became replaced by what he described as a magnificent high church, with a supreme being surrounded by hosts of celestial beings. Now, if you're familiar with Tibetan iconography, like the Tulku paintings, you'll often see these magnificent panoramas of a sage sitting in meditation, surrounded by the various domains of existence. And then the Buddha appears usually on the outside of the whole circle, because he's perfectly transcended all of it at the top right. And then there'll be various learned bodhisattvas and sages and teachers depicted in these pictures. And what Stabatsky's quoting on is religion, devotional, ceremonial and clerical. He's obviously seeing the comparison with medieval Catholicism. And from a European background, that's very much what it looked like. A religion of universal salvation of all living beings. Salvation is not an annihilation, but an eternal life. So he says, we are fully justified in maintaining that the history of religions has scarcely witnessed such a break between the new and old, between within the pale of what nevertheless continued to be the same religion. So it really was a revolution in ancient India at that time, between when the Mahayana started to emerge. That's the point I wanted to make about that, and we'll see that in as I develop the ideas in this. So that's the map, which I think you'd all be familiar with, which is generally regarded as being indicative of the actual geographical distribution. So the Theravada still is more strong in Burma, Thailand and Sri Lanka. I noticed that when I went to Bali in early 1980s, there was a Buddhist cave on Bali called the Elephant Caves, and it was Mahayana. And in fact, the a lot of the Javanese, those famous Angkor Wat, all of those, they tend to be Mahayana, actually. So the early Mahayana spread out through all of that area, but in the end, they were superseded basically by Hinduism in the Indonesian islands. And then, really, the Mahayana took root in China, Japan, and Korea. And the Theravada stronghold stayed Burma and Thailand and Sri Lanka. So, as I was saying, it started off, the scholars believe nowadays that the Mahayana started off as this movement called the Great Assembly, which was, the emphasis of which was that it was possible to live a Buddhist life as a lay person rather than just as a monastic. So it arose as kind of a liberal movement that provided a vehicle for the lay community. And there was this rethinking of the whole nature of the spiritual path in the Buddhist world. Now, I've got to sort of frame this by saying we're talking about a period of history thousands of years ago in a culture which was very vastly different to our own. In fact, the more, when you start to study these ancient texts, I mean, I start to realise how profoundly different they are and were. For a start, ancient India was like a real, how shall we say, spiritual supermarket. I mean, they had always recognised, and they're very different to the modern Western culture in that respect. There had been this strong sort of, not only was there, socialised sort of formal religion, like of the Vedas and the Hindus and the Brahmins, but there was this very strong belief in the value of renunciation and going to the forest and leaving the world behind. So the entire renunciate tradition, consisting of wandering sages who cut their ties with home and household and then went forth into the wilderness to pursue a life of contemplation and meditation. Something vastly different to anything, really any culture that exists anywhere else in the world, I think. And in fact, still in India to this day, that culture is still strong. They have that massive Hindu festival every few years. I can't recall the name of it, but it's like the largest assembly of persons you ever get anywhere on the planet. It's like literally millions of sadhus turn up and have these ongoing celebrations that go for, or ceremonies that go for weeks on end. So I put that in because I just wanted to frame the understanding that when there was a fair amount of sectarian rivalry, or how should we say, competition between these ideas of what constitutes the Buddhist path, but bear in mind that was the context in which all of this took place. It's quite different in today's world where we all coexist in a global environment. Just bear that in mind. Now, these words, Shravaka, Pratyeka, and Bodhisattva, these are the key words that became part of the debate of the understanding of what is the spiritual path underneath Buddhism. The Shravakas were the hearers of the doctrine. Have you done the Theravada part of these talks yet? And remember the talk about the stream winners and the once returners and the never returners? Will I just go through that just briefly again? Yeah. So there was this categorization in the Buddhist texts of various classes of disciples who've come along to have heard the Buddha and comprehended the teaching and taken it on. And they're recognized as being at various sort of levels of understanding. So there was the... I can't remember all of the terminology, but I know there was one class that was only destined to return no more than seven more lifetimes. There was a once returner who was only destined to one more lifetime, and there were never returners who were never actually going to have to be reborn into the cycle of birth and death again. And so that was, but from the viewpoint of the Mahasanghika, all of those classes of disciples were still amongst what they would call the hearers of the teaching. So they're essentially those who listen to the teaching and benefit from it and attain liberation through it. Then there was this class of being called Pratyeka, which were Buddhas who had realised enlightenment but who didn't teach. They were just silent. And they've always been recognised as part of the Buddhist sort of fold and part of the Buddhist tradition. But then there's this third character called the Bodhisattva. Now, Bodhi is actually, Bodhi is the word that was originally translated as enlightenment. So the Buddha is, how should you say, Bodhi incarnate. That is the very nature of wisdom which defines what the Buddha is. So Bodhi is the key attribute. A Bodhisattva is a one in whom the aspiration for enlightenment has been born and who kind of incarnates, because actually Bodhisattva means wisdom being. That's literally what it means. Sattva is being. Bodhisattva is wisdom being. Yeah. So Bodhi is wisdom, sattva is being, wisdom being. So you become a wisdom being. That's your entire being is defined by that. Now, they will say, let me just go back to the previous. There is this, the way it's taught in religious studies classes is that the bodhisattva, the arahat's aim is to realise enlightenment for him or herself. The bodhisattva, they say, the way they taught me when I did religious studies was that they postpone the realisation of their own enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. But I really don't like that idea of postponing or putting anything off. I feel as though they're always right on the very edge of that understanding, but for the benefit of others, they don't go there. And in fact, I read a very beautiful statement. I was reading a statement by the Dalai Lama some time ago. It was a statement about his understanding. Well, no, it's not just his understanding, it's the teaching of rebirth, reincarnation, according to the Dalai Lama. And he said that the Buddhist tradition understands that all beings can be born out of karma, which is their previous actions give rise to this life, but that the Mahayana recognises that a being can be born out of compassion. So the entire principle gives rise to the life of a bodhisattva. The bodhisattva is born from compassion, not born because they're compelled to be born, like most of us are. We're compelled to be born because we're craving for some experience, whereas the bodhisattva doesn't have to undergo anything like that. He's already, or she, able to let go of all of that. He's only born voluntarily. I think that's a very beautiful way of framing it. So it's much more like that than saying putting anything off or putting something away. It's just that your whole attitude is one of, how should we say, voluntarily being here for the purpose of compassion, which is the aspiration, I think, of the bodhisattva. So what is the Mahayana? So the Mahayana, at the time the Mahayana emerged, and we, as I say, this is lost in the mist of history, the word itself, the term itself means Maha is great and Yana is vehicle. Very simple, actually. And the idea of the vehicle in Buddhism goes back to, there's the famous parable of the raft, which is that the teaching itself is like a raft to cross the river of suffering. And actually, that is a very beautiful verse, and it's one of those very earthy metaphors and similes the Buddha gives, where he says, if this man approached the river, and there's a wide river, and he knew he couldn't swim across it, he would look around and grasp branches and twigs and bind them together and make it into a raft, and then he would use that to cross the river. And then he talks about how when he gets to the other side, he asks the monks, what would you do with that raft, monks? Would you pick it up and carry it about? And going, no, sir, carry it up. Would you, you know, make a big deal of the raft or worship? No, we'd leave it behind. So that is also the nature of my teaching. It is something with which to cross the river of suffering, but when it's crossed, then you let it go. Let go of Dharma is to say nothing of a Dharma. So this idea of it being like a means of transport, going somewhere, Mahayana. So it's the great vehicle. Why is it great? Because it's aiming at the aspiration, it's the aspiration of enlightenment of all beings. It's not concerned only with one's own spiritual path, it's concerned with the spiritual welfare of, well, when it says all beings, I think they mean that in a very broad sense. They don't just mean some beings, they don't mean people in this country or anything like that, they really mean all beings. And I suppose in the Buddhist view of life, they have a large enough view, when they say all beings, they have a big enough stage and a long enough time for that to be meaningful, because we'll get to that. Now, there are big ideas in the Mahayana. I should stress that. A lot of these ideas, when you start to explore the Mahayana, you'll realise there's some very, how should we say, mind-blowing ideas in it. Now, this point is that when the Mahayana emerged, it wasn't actually like a schism. And a schism is where there's a split, a bit like between Catholic and Protestant, and the whole movement has to, they recognise different leaders, that sort of thing. It wasn't a schism. And the reason they say it wasn't a schism is because there was a Chinese monastic, Fazian, I don't know how to say his name, but he was quite early. I think he was around 300 AD, our time. And he was sent by the emperor to go and get the Buddhist scriptures and take it back to the China, where it's translated. He noticed, and this is very early, it's like, as I say, I think it's around 300 in the Common Era. He said many of the monasteries in India at that time, they were both Mahayana and other schools all lived in the same monastery. They had different robes, but they worshipped. They worshipped the same. They had the same monastic rule, the Naya. So that's why it wasn't a schism, because they all observed the same basic schedule, routine, the same discipline. But the Mahayana had additional teachings, and you know, they had their own sort of ideas they were starting to develop, if you like. So it was not a schism. It was like a movement within the sort of Buddhist family. So monks and nuns of Shravakayana, which was the vehicle of the hearers, and the Mahayana, which originally the Mahayana was the Bodhisattvayana, which is the path of the Bodhisattva. So they actually lived and worked side by side in the same monasteries. So I want to stress that point. So the question was of orientation of practice rather than actual separate schools. And as I said, that point I made before about the fact that there was such a ferment of ideas about this kind of spiritual culture. In those days, like, understanding these very subtle spiritual principles was... Like, I remember I was reading a bit about the early Christian era, and people used to argue in the marketplace about the nature of the sun. You used to have these barnies, like, out in the street about articles of dogma. And, you know, like, in a spiritual culture, this is more important to people than bread and butter. You know, like, the way they engage with these ideas, it's like... really important stuff. It's not abstruse, it's not far away. This is what I'm doing here. You know, this is why I'm on the planet, sort of thing. And so that is a bit of a background again here, why they would have all of these debates. Now the other thing is that the various Mahayana sutras present the new teachings as being expounded by lay people. Now the thing is, the Mahayana sutras, the other key thing about them is they were written in Sanskrit. Now I have to say a little bit about that. As we know, the Pali canon, Pali is actually an ancient Indian language. It's very similar to Sanskrit, which is another ancient Indian language. It wasn't actually written down at all, as I said, for the first few hundred years of its existence. Everything was just recited. But Pali and Sanskrit, if you study both, and I have studied both, although I'm extremely poor at both of them, but they are very similar. The languages are almost the same, all of the word roots are the same. There are just different rules around grammar and the way the words put together. Many of the Pali words are like simplified versions of the Sanskrit ones. So, for example, the word bodhisattva in Sanskrit is bodhisattva in Pali, and there's just minor differences. But when the Mahayana started to emerge, this Sanskrit literature emerged with it. And the reason, actually, that's another thing which we're not all that clear about, but Sanskrit was the language of the Brahmins, and it was the language of the educated and scholarly class. And so in order to really get by in India of those days, if you wanted to impress the court or get royal patronage, you had to be able to speak Sanskrit and you had to start learning how to write it. And that's one of the characteristics of the early Mahayana, is that along with the beginning of this new understanding of the nature of the teaching, the new understanding of the Bodhisattva path being the path instead of just the Arhat path, was also the emergence of this Sanskrit literature, which the Theravadins would say, they would question. So now this is one of the fundamental divides between the two schools. Because the Theravada, as far as they're concerned, the Pali suttas are the word of the Buddha, they're the authentic teaching. They would question whether the Mahayana sutras are the word of the Buddha. They would question that. So I don't want to take sides here, I would just say that is a question. But the Mahayanists might say, for example, they might say, because the Buddha is, and we will get to this, not simply a physical being who's died, but in some sense is like an eternal being, then the Buddha can appear in these, what we say, visionary states. We can encounter the Buddha on various levels of awareness or consciousness, and this is what he is saying. So it was a more, esoteric type of idea of the nature of the Buddha. So this is what I said, it's got some big ideas in it. This is what we get into. Right. So, now this term Hinayana, I have to say a bit about that. It's usually regarded as being like a pejorative term. It's not a very nice thing to say about someone. You have a small part. Your vehicle is the small one. But the idea was that really, because of the fact that its concern is with the individual salvation and individual attainment of enlightenment, because it doesn't have this large view of trying to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings, So it's small compared to something pretty enormous, if you like. But Hinayana is not a word that's used in polite discourse when you're talking about Buddhist schools, because really it's like a technical distinction about difference in attitudes towards the nature of the practice. So Theravada is the proper name to use because that means the doctrine of the elders. So it's like the traditional understanding of the Buddhist tradition based on the Pali scriptures being the authentic teaching. And then from the Theravada viewpoint, the Mahayanas are very, how shall we say, imaginative. They devise these scriptures which may or may not be true, but we're pretty certain the Buddha didn't actually say them. These are the sort of arguments they have. You know? And so I don't want to take sides here, because you have to make your own mind up about that. So the way it emerged was, first of all, there was the, and there's other distinctions here, the Majjhimika was the beginning of the Mahayana. And now, what should I say about that? Okay, so as I said, what happened around the time of the emergence of the Mahayana as a separate type of entity was the beginning of writing the Buddhist Sanskrit sutras. And the first of those were called, and forgive my pronunciation, although probably nobody here speaks Sanskrit, but it's the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Now, Prajna is a Buddhist word which means transcendental wisdom, wisdom which sees beyond. There's Jnana is wisdom, Prajna is very high wisdom, sees beyond the ordinary. So the Prajnaparamita is the supreme perfect transcendental wisdom. So the supreme perfect transcendental wisdom sutras are this whole class of scripture that was composed in Sanskrit and then written down around the time of, say, like 0 AD, around that time. First century in the Common Era, and the first century before the Common Era. This is where they started to appear, these scriptures. And they were very large, like there was the Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines. And they were written according to very strict meter. So they're made to be recited, and they're very, very beautiful. If you listen to the Sanskrit language, is very captivating, and it lends itself to being chanted. And the way these scriptures were disseminated is they were memorized and recited. And so if you were a Mahayana monk, then you would learn many of these and recite them every day. Like I think all, like I found with in my own practice, that chanting forms a real foundation part of it, for reasons that I don't necessarily consciously get. It just seems to be really very much part of the practice. There's a beautiful site, there's a few sites where there are people starting to recite these Prajnaparamita Sutras again properly, in the proper Sanskrit, and it's a beautiful language to hear. But anyway, these are the scriptures that started to appear, and they were really radical ideas in these. They were really based on this teaching of emptiness, which I don't think I'll try and get too much into tonight because it's a big and deep topic. The teaching of emptiness, however, was part already of the Buddhist teaching. And in fact, one thing to notice about the Mahayana is all the ideas in the Mahayana were already present in the early teachings, but they received a new emphasis in the way the Mahayana brought them out and taught them. So the Bodhisattva was already present as an idea in the Theravada, in the earlier teachings. But the Mahayana brought it out and really made it front and centre of the whole teaching. The idea of emptiness, which is sunatha in Pali, as in Sunatharam, monastery, and sunyata in Sanskrit, was also central to both the early teachings and the later ones. When you start to study the Buddhist scriptures, you realise, and this is probably not a controversial thing to say, there are many layers of meaning in them, many layers. And the Buddha was obviously a teacher of ultimate profundity. And so there are ways to interpret some of the passages that he spoke on a lot of levels. And so I think perhaps what happened, one way of understanding the emergence of the Sanskrit texts and the Mahayana movement was as the deep and profound meaning of the Buddha's teachings circulated down through generations of disciples, they started to realise these layers of meaning that were there in the teaching and bring it forth. So they called themselves, when they said, according to Mahayana, when the Buddha gave the sermon at the deer park in Benares, where you see the two deers, and that was the beginning, first turning of the wheel. And they say the discovery of the Majjhimika was the second turning of the wheel. And that was the legendary origin of that, was that Nagarjuna was dispatched somewhere to the Southern Oceans, and at the bottom of the Southern Oceans, he found the nagas, which are snake beings, guarding the Prajnaparamita teachings. And he retrieved them and started to teach them. That's the legendary story. And then we won't talk about Yogacara this week. It was too much. So that's a recap of... Oh, golly, that typeface doesn't look very nice. I think I lost my... It's meant to be like that. It's in the transition to PowerPoint. Modern technology for you. I had my nice papyrus font. The goal of Mahayana is the great enlightenment of all beings. And the way is through bodhicitta. The compassionate wish to serve liberation of all beings. Now, my experience of bodhicitta actually is that... it's kind of like a reservoir which you have to tap into. It's not something under your conscious control, I've discovered. I think when I met Lama Yeshe, I went to one talk by him, but there was a lot of stuff, there were a lot of things happening in my practice at the time, and I think he managed to activate something. And it was like there's a tap or a valve or something, and it starts to flow. That's what bodhicitta is like. So it's not something necessarily under your conscious control, but It's like this quality you start that starts to develop of compassion towards all beings. That's all. So the bodhisattva ideal, bodhisattva is the embodiment of realization, committed to the enlightenment of all sentient beings. And the great bodhisattvas embody different aspects. So if you go to practice centers in anywhere really in Northern Asia, quite often you will see there are depictions of various bodhisattvas who embody various qualities. So Manjusri embodies wisdom, and I suppose really in those traditions, like certain bodhisattvas can be called on for certain kinds of, in the same way the patron saints were in the Catholic era. It's pretty similar really, if you look at it from a comparative religion or archetypal psychology viewpoint. Avalokiteshvara is also Kuan Yin. It's the bodhisattva that became Kuan Yin in China. So these are great, how shall we say, archetypal figures of wisdom and enlightenment. And there is, I think there's only a small number of famous ones, but there are thousands or millions of them. I mean, the other thing is that a bodhisattva might be anybody. Because they're not always like these exalted celestial beings. They might actually be service station attendants or whatever it takes to, you know, do the job that needs to be done at that time. So one of the key understandings of associated with the Mahayana was skillful means. Because the bodhisattva has to lead all beings to enlightenment, and the bodhisattva has to learn to speak to them on their level and has to learn to appear in a guise that they'll recognise, which may not necessarily seem like a Buddhist guise at all. They might appear to you or appear to us in many different forms and undertake many different kinds of tasks and duties. And bodhisattvas might even, take the risk of forgetting who they are, so to speak, because that's all part of the great path. Now, the typeface. I lost my papyrus. Now, look, the papyrus is the top one, you see, and the rest of them stay. Now, this is where the Mahayana gets really a mind-blowing philosophy, because I've discovered when I read a bit of Mahayana scriptures, and despite what Tina says, I know like this minute percentage of this material. It's just absolutely, there's so much of it, and I'm not at all well educated. But I have discovered that they will make these references to all of the life-bearing orbs throughout the universe. So ever since the Buddhist times, the Buddhists seem to have understood that the universe itself has many different planets and world systems with sentient beings on them. In fact, they even have numbers for them. It's always some number involving 84, I think, 84 million or something like that. And there are chapters, there are verses where the Buddha will recall Manjusri from an incarnation on some other, it's like Star Wars or something. You have to come back here and help with this situation. It really is quite extraordinarily like vast, their view of the world, because they understand the universe is continually goes through cycle. Everything is cyclical. And so the universe expands and contracts through cycles of creation and destruction, which to me seems like a very feasible representation of the way modern cosmology actually looks at things, because they think it's a big bang and then the in-breathing and out-breathing and so forth, that sort of thing. So that is not given a lot of prominence when you study these texts, but it's a sort of a background factor. So the universe is infinitely vast in space and time. These other lines here, I don't think I'm going to talk about at the moment because there's too much in them. But I did want to talk about this one. So whereas we saw in the traditional understanding, the Buddha was... Now, was the Buddha a human being? It's a very interesting question. In actual fact, there's a verse about this where the Buddha is asked, what kind of being are you? Are you a god? No. Are you a yaksa? Which is some kind of deity? No. I think the word is, are you a man? And at that point he says, I am Buddha, I'm awake. So I've had quite a few discussions with this with people over the years, because I don't want to say the Buddha is not human. Like, I don't want to say that. But I think he's something also more than what we understand human to be. Because, and in that verse, he says, who else has, you know, cut this cord of suffering? You know, so that's the Buddha is a unique being. The Buddha is Buddha. It can't be explained in other terms. He's not a god, he's not a person, like in the sense we are. But in any case, in the Mahayana understanding, they really expanded the idea of who the Buddha was to being... the Buddha signifies a supreme ultimate reality. I suppose a lot of people would say, do you mean a god by that? Well, no, Buddhists don't mean god by that, because that word god carries a lot of connotations and baggage, and it has its own traditions, and sort of, we don't want to get mixed up in all of that speculation. But something which is much higher than we can actually imagine with our own minds, you know. So it is understood this ultimate reality manifests in accordance with the realization of the perceiver. So this is called the three bodies. And this is really essential to the Mahayana, which is why I put this slide up. So these are big ideas, as I said. So just take them away and think about them. The Dharmakaya, the truth body, is the ultimate reality underlying the whole universe. So the Buddha awakens to the Dharmakaya. The Buddha understands and sees. And like, by way of comparison, in our own life and mind, our own understanding is always bound by our experience of the world and our perception and our attachments to it, all of which is well and good. There's nothing the matter with that. But the Buddha understands on a level which is inconceivable to ordinary human beings. So the Dharmakaya is, I suppose, it's the nearest understanding in Buddhism, which is, it is somewhat like some conceptions of the nature of God in the Western tradition, but you have to qualify that, because as I said before, you don't want to like mix up these traditions and understandings. There's certain mystical understandings of the nature of the Supreme Being or the Supreme Reality, which is similar to that in some ways. But the Dharmakaya or the Buddhist understanding is unique to itself. It doesn't need to borrow anything from other traditions. But this is just to help you sort of try and frame what sort of an idea it is. So they say that the three bodies are the Dharmakaya, the enjoyment body, which is the way that reality appears to the Bodhisattva, and the form body, which is what allows the Buddha to actually manifest as a physical being. Big ideas, as I say. But these are the kinds of ideas that really delineated the Mahayana from the other traditions, because, and this was radical, as I'm saying, at the time these teachings were brought out, the more conservative followers of the religion were, how shall we say, taken aback. This is not what they expected to hear, you know. This is very surprising. Where are these ideas coming from? What are you talking about here? So it's radical. The Mahayanists were really radical people. They were very, very, very bold thinkers. And so they put their list of what the qualities of the Bodhisattva. These are the things. Now, whenever I put this slide up, I feel not very confident. I certainly know that I don't embody all of these great six heroic perfections in my life every day of the week. In fact, very rarely. So I don't think I want to put these up here and say, we should all be like this. Because it seems like a big ask. I mean, who does go through life with the perfection of giving, the perfection of behaviour and discipline, the perfection of forbearance, with an E missing, perfection of vigour and diligence, and so forth. But I need to put them up there because these are the six perfections that were taught by the Mahayana as being the... And now, I just read an article the other day which points out that these are all associated with the stories of the Buddha's life. There's this lovely group of stories called the Jataka Tales, which is the story of the Buddha before he became Gautama the Buddha, and all of the... They're sort of edifying stories about how in various situations the Buddha was always able to manifest one of these qualities in some heroic action. By, you know, like he might appear as a tiger or as a deer or as all different kinds of characters, but he would always triumph, and, well, not triumph, but in whatever situation he was in, he would manifest one of these qualities. And that's where they think all this came from. The sort of, these are like the ideal qualities that should be possessed by the Bodhisattva. So I'll just leave those there for a minute so we can contemplate them.
Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
So we've got this concept of perfection. It would seem to me that if a life was dedicated to the towards, say, the perfection of one of these areas, that perfection in itself would, you know, would imply that enlightenment has been achieved with the one. And it seems in some practices that they, some traditions, there are practices that that follow one or the other.
I think that's probably quite true. Yeah. Because one implies all the rest of the thing.
Yeah.
If you bring one to perfection, then the others will naturally be inclined to. Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. I wouldn't disagree with that. All right, I want to go to that one. I mentioned some of the scriptures. I just thought I'd put some of the names of them up here because that gives you some orientation. Like this one, the Vajra Chetika, is the Diamond Sutra, which is one of the ones that's still very popular today. And I think you were talking about that when I came in.
We have a talk coming up, a series of talks.
Oh, okay. I've got some, now I've got some things to say about that, actually. Because it does give you an idea of the Diamond Sutra is a marvellous scripture, and it's very paradoxical. Like it doesn't, a lot of things about the Mahayana, when you read them, you just think, how can that be possibly true? And I've got a little verse from it here. The Vajra Chetika is this dialogue. Now, the other thing about the Mahayana scriptures is they tended to become, some of them are pretty fantastic in the sense that whereas the original, the Pali text will say the Buddha was at one time staying in the village of so-and-so, in the grove of so-and-so, and somebody approached him and sat to his right and made the polite inquiry. Quite often the Mahayana sutras, you'll find the Buddha is actually accompanied by a retinue of hundreds of thousands of fully enlightened arahants and hundreds of thousands of other kinds of beings. And then suddenly all of this array of remarkable lights will appear in the sky, flowers will fall from the sky, and jewels will manifest, this sort of thing. So this is very much part of the sort of imagination of the early Mahayana sort of movement. They were really, as I said, they were revolutionary type of people and thinkers, and that gave rise, many of these scriptures then became the source of entire schools. For example, the Vajra Chetika Prajnaparamita Sutra is really the main sutra underneath behind Chinese Zen Buddhism, because Hui Neng, who was the 6th Zen patriarch, was enlightened by hearing one verse from that when he was in the market one day. He heard somebody repeat a line from it, and at that moment he realised the truth of it. And so forth. So these verses, as I said before, they're often written in a kind of a poetic form, and you learn to recite them, and that recitation and the meaning of that sutra is your practice for your life. Like, this is what you practice, what you learn. And they can that's why they become the whole basis for, I mean, even though there's this huge amount of, or huge diversity of literature, quite often, I think in these schools, you learn one of them and you find the one that you relate to, and you learn it and you recite it, and that becomes your verse, your teaching. And so I do have an excerpt here from the Diamond Sutra, which gives you an idea of the paradoxical quality of it. But for some reason, it's paradoxically disappeared. Oh, no, here it is. But what is that, the ideal? Now, there's the Diamond Sutra, there's a lovely translation of it online. If you look for Diamond Sutra, there's been a nice translation made where there's one slide per verse. But it's a discussion. Now, the Diamond Sutra, unlike the one where there is the miraculous displays of lights and flowers and that sort of thing, it starts off very prosaically. It says the Buddha went around for his alms one morning, and he came back, sat down, washed his bowl and put it away. That in itself is part of the teaching, because it shows his very ordinary sort of routine in a day. Washed his bowl, put it away, and he sat down and has a dialogue with one of the senior monks. Now, quite often in these verses, they'll have certain characters like Subhuti, one of the disciples, and he'll, or Sariputra is another one, and they represent various qualities. So Bodhisattva Subhuti is discussing with Buddha. Tell me, Subhuti, the Buddha says, does a Buddha say to himself, I have obtained perfect awakening? No, Lord, there is no such thing as perfect awakening to obtain. If a perfectly awakened Buddha were to say to himself, I am awakened, he would be admitting thereby that there is an individual person, a separate self or entity, and would therefore not be a perfectly awakened Buddha. Scary. One must create this resolved attitude of mind. I must help to lead all beings to the shore of awakening. But after all these beings have become liberated, in truth I know that not even a single person has been liberated. Why is this so? If a disciple cherishes the idea of a self, a person, a living being, or a universal self, then that person is not an authentic disciple. Because, in fact, there is no independently existing object of mind called the highest, most fulfilled, and awakened mind. So it's very paradoxical teachings, a lot of these Mahayana teachings. They're very shocking to people. In fact, there's a well-known modern text on the Heart Sutra, which is another one of these class of sutras, and it's called the Heart Attack Sutra. Because when they say the sutra, a lot of people would go, oh, and just... Now, I was saying to Tina when I came in, I was reading one of the Prajnaparamita Sutras the other week, and I noticed that it says, kept on saying, the Bodhisattva, even though the Bodhisattva knows this, he is not disappointed. He's, you know, he's still going, what's he not disappointed by? He's not disappointed by the fact there's no gain from it. There's nothing to actually get. You know, and this, because we have this universal motivation, we feel as though we're going to get something. And this is what it's trying to undercut all the time. That's why when the first book I learnt, the book that taught me the very most about Buddhist practice was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Shunryu Suzuki Roshi. And he always said, practice with no gaining idea. Practice with no idea of gain. He said, if you feel as though you're going to get something from this, then you're wasting your time and you're pushing. And I found that really paradoxical because, well, why do I have to get up every morning? You know, why do I have to do this practice, which is basically really unpleasant, I don't like doing it, if I don't get anything from it? I found the only way is to keep going. And then you start to learn it. So, let me see now. I think that's basically all I wanted to cover tonight. Is that enough, do you think, at the moment? Or shall I keep going? Or I don't know if I've got any more slides. That's from the Heart Sutra, but I don't know if I want to read that at the moment. And then I'll go off into the Nagarjuna and so forth.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, I would like to engage in a bit of discussion about it. I could probably find something else to say if you don't have any questions.
Well, you skipped a few slides. They looked interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When we look at progressive movements throughout all periods of time,
yeah,
there tends to be a lot of splintering, because imagination is very much, creativity, imagination is very much a part of the progressive.
Yes.
Are there any checks and balances inside the Mahayana traditions to prevent people, through their imagination, rationalising their own teaching, which may not be true?
That is a really interesting question. I think part of the answer is they recognise the same Vinaya. They recognise the monastic rule. And I think that has to be part of the answer, because that meant they were bound by a lot of commonality in terms of conventions and behaviours and so forth. That's part of the answer. But that's something I don't think I could answer without having to do a bit of research. I really do see the... And there is this tension in the way the Mahayana developed as well, because, as we said, first of all, there was the Madhyamika, and Nagarjuna was felt to be, how shall we say, quite radical in his day. But then his approach was very austere in a way, because the emptiness teaching is, how shall we say, it's not a very, doesn't sort of... But when you get up to the next school, which is the mind-only school, that's exactly, there was a lot of tension, is this still a Buddhist teaching? And there's still, the mind-only teaching had this understanding of the alaya vijnana, which is like the collective unconscious or the universal mind. And that sort of universal mind, I mean, that sounds very much like what we were trying to, trying to differentiate from the Hindu, the Vedanta understanding of the universal mind. And a lot of them said there was tension in the Buddhist movement because they felt that this was going too much towards a Vedanta sort of approach. And some of those tensions I don't think ever really got resolved, but the way they resolve it is, that's why they have the idea of a dialectic. It's like a discussion. There was certain teachers who put forward these very bold innovations, and they'd be given a certain amount of, they'd be given respect and a hearing and following and become part of the corpus of teaching, but it was just one pole in the discussion. Like one, that's why they say the Madhyamika is a dialectic, it's like a debate between various possible viewpoints, but no viewpoint is supreme, because if it's a supreme viewpoint, then it becomes a dogma. So I think that's part of the answer in a way, but it's a very difficult question, that one. And I think, sort of walking the fine line between maintaining, orthodoxy and introducing something which is a real departure, I think that's a deep question. Yeah, I don't really have an answer to it.
Say, part of that is also lineage.
Yeah, that's probably true also, yeah. Yeah, and validation from the teachers as well.
The teachers have to validate.
That is true. Attainments. Yeah. And there was also very, there was always a strong, how shall we say, prohibition on being on schismatics. And like creating a schism in the order was regarded as being, I think, a parajika offence or something. If you could be shown to really create a schism, it was something which was very strongly discouraged for obvious reasons. But at the same time, it's because you're dealing with a dynamic movement which is growing and evolving, as you say, it's sometimes a very hard thing to manage. Well, on the whole, the Buddhists managed it pretty well, I think, because they did manage to incorporate a huge range of ideas and still maintain a central understanding, which not all different spiritual traditions have managed to do that, I don't think. And you see, the other thing about the Buddhists is they've managed to adapt to so many different cultural circumstances so effectively, including the modern world, I think. Yeah.
Do the three Dharma seals fit in there somewhere?
Yes, they do. Yeah, I think all Buddhists say that anything they teach has to everything has to be, like, it's the recognition of impermanence and so forth. Yes, very much so. I mean, now Nagarjuna never said that he represented the Mahayana. He, as far as he was concerned, he was just teaching the Dharma. When he came along, there had been a lot of development of what they call the Abhidharma, and there was a lot of, scholastic philosophy that had been developed. It was actually quite complex. I think the Sarvastivada were one of those schools. They had all of these very detailed types of schemas of the mental factors and all that sort of thing. And Nagarjuna was very, radical critic of trying to get back to the core, what he saw as the core teaching of the Buddha, beyond all of these mental categories, and the categorizations in scholasticism. So he would use all of the arguments of the philosophers against them. So he was very adroit at taking somebody's argument and turning it back against them and showing that the argument that they were trying to use actually undercut itself. And they'd say to him, well, what's your argument? I've just shown you. You know, like I've shown you what the problem is with your argument. I mean, I don't have an argument. What your problem is you've got an argument. In fact, there's a saying, there's this discussion between, there's a character in the early teachings called Vajragatha, who's a wandering sage, who's always asking philosophical questions. And the Buddha says to Vajra, I love this phrase where he says, I do not entertain the writhings and thickets of views. You know, like all of these disputations that people get into, I don't entertain any of it. And there's that, as for me, you know, he's so talkative and always full of arguments and disputations. I know nothing other than arguments and disputations. But somewhere I can feel the appeal of that total absence of them. That's why I get up and sit in the morning, I think. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just I just want to confirm whether my understanding was correct.
So, yeah.
From the point of view of a lay practitioner,
yeah.
So Mahayana tradition is more external, right? It's almost like there's this supreme being there, and then if almost like God worshipping, or if I do something I'm told I should do, then it'll be okay. And then Theravada is more internal.
I don't know. Look, one thing we didn't touch on tonight is in Chinese Buddhism, there's the Amitabha Buddhism. Amitabha means boundless, which is a very devotional. I'd rather see it more in terms of in the Indian spiritual traditions. There's devotionalism, and there's the six schools of yoga: bhakti, karma, jnana, raja, that sort of thing. So there's different kinds of personalities have different ways of relating to the spiritual path. You know? Mm-hmm. I'm a bit uncomfortable about the idea of supreme being because of the fact that, you know, like Buddhists, like they differentiate themselves from teachers, God teachers. Like this, in fact, one of the slides I did get here, which I've got to get to at the end, was the one that everybody has in common. Oh, I can't find where I put it. If I get out of here, I might be able to find it. If I get into the actual back of the, there it is. Yeah, because one of the things that all Buddhists say, they don't accept the existence of a creator God. So I don't want to put words in their mouth or anything like that. I'd say in answer to your question, though, the emphasis to Mahayana is because of the fact that it's not exclusively about a monastic tradition, that you can have a very committed spiritual life in as an ordinary person living in the world. Now, one of the scriptures that's about that is the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is a pretty deep one, pretty hard to study. But it's about the character who was a silk merchant, and he has a family and children and all that sort of thing. And they all, I haven't studied in depth, I've only read a few summaries of it, but I know that the Buddha sends all the bodhisattvas to go and interview Vimalakirti, and they're all rather frightened of him, because his understanding of emptiness is so profound that he makes them all feel like school children type of thing. And he's a householder and a merchant and that sort of thing. So that division between the monastic life and the worldly life was not so great in the Mahayana. That was one of the reasons I think it came about, as I said, because there was this requirement to feel as though, you know, like it was something you could realise in day-to-day life without having to necessarily renounce the world, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of whether or not that's seen as a supreme being, that's up to you, I guess. But I think it's more like my understanding is very hard to explain. It's actually not complicated, but it's what I've learned through sitting practice is it's called like the negative way, which is like. There's a Christian scripture, I have to admit, it is a Christian one, called the cloud of unknowing, which is like that, where you just realise the complete incapacity of the thinking mind to understand, like, the nature of being. You know? Like, so it's this continual, and so when you try and say it, it sounds so awkward, but it's really a very simple thing. You have to stay with silence. I'm trying to find this slide I put in here, which has got all of the things that both Theravada and Mahayana accept. And is that it? Yes, this is it. It's a lot of words here, but I'll just go through it quickly. That one of the, in this is by the teacher, the writer of that book, What the Buddha Taught, Wahala Rupala, his name is? Yeah, it's here, the book. And he said, these are things which all the Mahayana and Theravada schools have in common, which I thought was important to show, because, again, I don't want to give the idea that it's like a schism or a split. It's just a different type of sensibility. Buddha is the only master. We take refuge in the three jewels. We do not believe the world is created and ruled by God. We consider the purpose of life is to develop compassion for all living beings without discrimination, to work for their good, happiness and peace. We accept the Four Noble Truths. All conditioned things are impermanent. We accept the 37 factors of enlightenment. Don't ask me to name what they are. Three ways of attaining Bodhi as disciples, Raka, Prajeka, and Sammasambuddha, perfectly and fully enlightened Buddha. And we admit that in different countries there are differences regarding Buddhist beliefs and practices. So I think you can live with the fact that there's different interpretations. I mean, I can anyway. I feel naturally, personally, I feel more drawn to the Mahayana myself. It's because, well, I don't know why, because I just do. That's just ever since I first discovered, probably because I discovered Buddhism through reading books about Zen. And Zen is Mahayana school.
And yet it seems very different from, say, Pure Land.
It is. There's a fellow called David Brazier. Have you heard of him? He's a British psychotherapist and Buddhist teacher. And he's really good. I'd recommend some of his books, David Brazier, because he's got a pretty good understanding of both Zen and Pure Land. And I mean, I learned some interesting things, a lot of interesting things from him, because he's, well, you know, he's a contemporary, and he's, so knows that I sort of relate to his writing style and everything. He gave me a lot of insight. I started looking into some of those Pure Land teachings and related teachings, and I thought, gee, you know, the more I learn, the more I realise I don't know. There's so many things there to study, but they're not what I would have thought. I mean, no, you've just got to study them. Shin, also Shin Buddhism is another one.
So what was the name? The
David Brazier. Brazier. His book is, the one I've got of his is Not Everything. B-R-A-Z-I-E-R, David Brazier. Yeah, he's got a book called Not Everything is Impermanent. And Buddhism is a religion. You can believe it.
Jonathan, would you say in your study of the suttas,
yeah,
like we were saying before, there's so many different levels.
Yes.
And what I often find is when people first enter into understanding Mahayana Buddhism, or Zen Buddhism, or Pure Buddhism, they can take it at a very superficial level, or they may misunderstand it completely, similar to what Brenda was expressing in terms of that. But when you actually start to practice the suttas, to really understand it and give it some depth, it's probably different to what you imagine, or what people imagine it to be initially.
Yes.
And that's what I found in terms of Mahayana Buddhism, that there are so many different levels of it.
Yeah.
And so when people talk about Amitabha, for example,
yeah,
he's not a supreme being.
No.
He's not someone who's bestowing karma on people, bestowing good merit. And it's not about chanting his name and then you would be reborn. Now, I know that's usually how it's explained, but there's actually a deeper meaning to it as well.
Yeah, true. Yeah. But the whole time I'm studying Buddhism, I'm realising, again, like my understanding changes all the time. It's like, oh, it's not like that after all. It's like this, you know. And that's one of the reasons it's good to have sangha. It's good to have people you speak to all the time, and it's good to have a teacher as well. I mean, it's essential actually, because otherwise you can, you know, go off on a tangent or a sidetrack, and you need to have somebody to. And that's what the Dharma group I used to go to with you was so helpful, because you know that interaction and this reality check. That's true. There's so many levels of interpretation, but at the same time, the Buddha's teaching, even though on one hand it's very profound and deep, but always the spiritual teachings is always something very simple and direct as well. You have to remember that simplicity and that directness. It's the key thing. Always has to do with the heart, opening of the heart, which sounds like a sappy New Age thing to say, but it's like you learn. There's actually something that happens through spiritual practice which is not under your control. It's not a personal type of thing. It's like there is something that gets, it's like a valve opened or something. And it just changes the quality of your mind. It really it touches you and in a way that just completely, it does transform your understanding of the nature of things. And that's all we can hope to achieve through it. Yeah.
And here's why I emphasize that it's really a lived experience. It's a lived practice rather than just reading the words and understanding
very much
based
so.
On the words. Yeah. But really living it, bringing it to your heart, as you say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that's all the slides I had.
Maybe there are any questions we can leave for next time.
Yeah.
She'll be back next week anyway.
Okay. Well, I'll do some more slides.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. And next week, what would you be talking about roughly?
Well,
the
talk we had at the Dharma Group a year ago on consciousness only, mind only Buddhism, that's really good. And it's got lots of content.
I won't run out of slides for
that one. Yeah, it's I think it's actually easier to communicate than Nagarjuna, which he's notoriously difficult even for everybody. You know, like it's just hard to understand. Mind only is also like that in some ways, but it's got some great things in it. And also, I found a really good essay on it, and the essay goes with the slides, and so I can even bring a handout.
Fantastic. Yeah. Oh, or even if you want to send it to me beforehand, I'm happy to.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
So looking forward to everyone back here next week for part two. Mm. And if anyone is interested in reading the suttas, we can also send out links with it too. Mm. We do have the Heart Sutra book here. It's only a thin one, but it's very good. So if anyone's interested in the English translation of that, that's available free of charge as well.
Mm.
Yes. And just a few announcements. So we've got Bhante Jason at the back. He'll be back here on Saturday to do a two-part workshop. The first part is this Saturday. And it's called DIY Meditation. Ante, would you like to say anything about it?
Sure. So it's a meditation workshop over 2 days, and each session being 3 hours. And it's designed to be based upon early Buddhist principles found inside the suttas. And it comes from the perspective that the suttas teach meditation in the form of principles rather than techniques. Mm. And in the forms of concrete signposts or progress. So what I want to do in 2-3 hour sessions is give you a global overview by which you can create your own techniques and know whether or not you're going forwards or backwards.
What time? What time are the sessions?
It starts at 8 a.m. on Saturday. But I eat